I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens.
I kept Denise in the closet for decades, and it was a great feeling for me when at age 49, I was finally able to have Denise come out for good.
We really wanted to focus on William John Banks' story, that story from 1841, but recognise that there are connections between his experiences and the experiences of LGBTQ people today.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A hunt for homosexuals begins in Burundi, true confessions of a self-made woman, and a historic exhibit ropes Brits into honoring the exile. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending October 14th, 2017. A homophobic virus seems to be spreading in more countries. We've told you in the past few weeks about Chechnya-like purges of gay people in Azerbaijan and Egypt. Police officials in Burundi announced an official hunt for homosexuals this week in their country. Several people, including teenagers reportedly arrested simply for dancing together, have already been jailed and forced to bribe officials to gain their freedom. Those who can't afford the extortion face beatings, heavy fines that they likely also can't pay, and up to 2 years in prison. President Pierre Nkurunziza announced the enforcement of a ban on homosexuality in Burundi's penal code in 2009. And according to Human Rights Watch, Nkurunziza is responsible for a spiral of political violence and widespread human rights abuses in the East African country. The youth wing of the ruling party is said to target opponents and perceived opponents who they kill, rape, torture, forcibly disappear, or ill-treat. The government has already shut down the most prominent Burundian human rights organizations.
LGBTQ people in Indonesia have been under siege for several months through frequent police raids that have been urged on by high-level government officials and blessed by top religious authorities. Even though President Joko Widodo has denounced anti-queer discrimination and same-gender sex is not specifically illegal in Indonesia, except in Islamic law-governed Aceh province, cultural disapproval has made it virtually impossible to publicly support basic human rights for sexual and gender minorities in the world's most populous, predominantly Muslim nation. A police raid on October 6th at a sauna in Jakarta that's popular with gay men netted 58 people. The detainees include 4 men from China, 1 from Thailand, 1 from Singapore, 1 Malaysian, and 1 Dutchman. Authorities said none of the foreigners would be charged.
Human Rights Watch reported that most of the people caught up in the raid had been released by the following day. 4 men and 1 woman remain behind bars, however, and are charged with violating Indonesia's strict anti-pornography laws, which prohibit sex parties, distribution of pornography, sex with animals or corpses, and oral or anal sex by gay or straight consenting adults. 141 other people were arrested during the raid on a spa in Jakarta in May in what authorities called a sex party. 5 suspected lesbians were arrested in June, and their names and a video of the raid were shared with reporters. And 12 women were evicted from their shared home in September because neighbors believed them to be lesbians.
The United Nations Human Rights Office condemned the escalating attacks on LGBTQ people in Azerbaijan, Egypt, and Indonesia this week. UN spokesman Rupert Colville told a news conference that arresting or detaining people based on their actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity is by definition arbitrary and violates international law. In all 3 countries, he charged, authorities have alleged that those arrested were involved in sex work, although in almost all cases the accused have denied such allegations or indicated that they were coerced into confessing involvement. Colville called for those governments to drop charges based on vague or discriminatory laws and to repeal those laws.
But the rights of transgender people have advanced in Greece. Parliament passed legislation this week that allows trans people to change their legal gender without having to undergo reassignment surgery or sterilization. It also eliminates a required psychiatric diagnosis of gender identity disorder. The law covers anyone aged 17 and older. Children between the ages of 15 and 17 will also have access to the legal gender recognition process, but they'll still need to get a certificate from a medical council at Athens Children's Hospital. While LGBTQ activists generally celebrated the relaxed regulations, they noted that further progress remains. Married trans people can change their legal gender only if they divorce their partner, and the law also still blocks access to legal gender recognition for transgender refugees and migrants.
As your president, I will do everything in my power to protect our LGBTQ citizens from the violence and oppression of a hateful foreign ideology. Believe me.
That was candidate Donald Trump at the Republican National Convention in July 2016. Of course, he neglected to include hateful domestic ideology in his protection promises. And the administration of President Donald Trump has been actively trying to overturn virtually every LGBT rights advance made during the 8 years of Barack Obama. In recent weeks, the Justice Department began arguing in federal court that anti-LGBT bias is not outlawed under provisions of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bans discrimination based on sex. Obama-era guidelines to protect transgender students were thrown out, and honorably serving transgender service members face involuntary discharge if Trump's proposed ban is enacted. This week, the administration set its sights on queer seniors and even the rainbow flag.
The Department of Health and Human Services has withdrawn a December 2014 directive assuring that same-gender spouses are treated equally to heterosexual spouses in long-term care facilities that receive Medicare and Medicaid funds. Most nursing homes and hospitals depend on that federal assistance to stay in business. The Obama-era directive was issued after the Supreme Court's Windsor decision overturned key parts of the Defense of Marriage Act in 2013, but before the High Court struck down all state bans on marriage equality in 2015. An agency spokesperson explained that the Trump administration believes it is no longer necessary to enforce the directive since the Supreme Court issued its nationwide marriage equality ruling. Several queer rights groups noted, however, that previous Supreme Court rulings have stressed the importance of specifically naming groups who are protected from discrimination to allow a non-discrimination law to have its intended effect.
Meanwhile, the first ever raising of the rainbow flag over federal land, scheduled for October 11th, National Coming Out Day, made history, with an asterisk, and in spite of efforts by the U.S. Department of Interior to spoil the celebration by pulling out of the dedication ceremony its officials had arranged. Equality activists speculated that Trump administration officials became uncomfortable with the advance publicity of the historic day. So the rainbow flag flies adjacent to the Stonewall National Monument, but the flagpole itself is located on land owned by New York City, and it's not the part of Christopher Park that constitutes the first national monument dedicated to queer rights created by the Obama administration in 2014. Veteran activist Ann Northrup, who was scheduled to MC the dedication ceremony, blasted the Trump administration shenanigans on the weekly Gay USA TV show she co-hosts with Andy Hum.
They think we are so disgusting and so filthy that they cannot even let a little rainbow flag fly on federal land. This is the smallest of our concerns and yet so emblematic of how we are treated and how they want to continue to deprive us of any legitimacy as regular human beings.
In other news, it's now legal in the state of Mississippi for government workers and private businesses to refuse to serve LGBT people based on sincerely held religious belief or moral conviction. What critics call the most oppressive so-called religious freedom law in the United States, HB 1523, went into effect on October 10th after last-ditch efforts in federal court to delay its implementation were unsuccessful. The law spells out three underlying beliefs: that marriage is only possible between one man and one woman, that proper sexual relations occur only between married heterosexual couples, and that gender is an innate characteristic established at birth that cannot be changed. Initial reporting by local media outlets, however, predict that the actual impact of the law will be negligible, that only a handful of county clerks will refuse to issue marriage licenses to same-gender couples, and that the vast majority of businesses will not turn away queer dollars. Nevertheless, several LGBTQ legal advocacy groups are already petitioning the U.S. Supreme Court to review the constitutionality of the law.
And finally, President Trump tweeted in his late July edict proposing a ban on military service by transgender people that he arrived at that decision after consultation with my generals and military experts. Dozens of congresspeople sent a letter to Defense Secretary James Mattis this week asking for specifics. The October 10th letter was signed by 114 members of Congress, all Democrats, of course. Virginia Representative A. Donald McEachin wrote the letter and spearheaded the effort to get his colleagues to sign. "We seek information to discover the proof of where and when the Pentagon advised the president that this was the best idea for our country," McEachin explained in a press release. "If there is proof, then we can evaluate that. If there is no proof, then the president lied to the American people once again." Does anyone believe we'll ever see that proof?
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 14th, 2017. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
You walk in the doorway and it's awe-inspiring, if you like. It makes you stand there and think about your own person, your own body, if you like. And you're looking at all these knots in the ropes and thinking, that could have been me 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Britain's present meets the past, later in the program.
Whether I'm right or whether I'm wrong, whether I find me a place in this world or I'd never be long, I gotta be me, I gotta be me. What else can I be but what I am?
Denise Dubois is a self-made woman, just like the title of her new coming of gender memoir. The book intrigued This Way Out correspondent Dixie Trackle with the same stories that first captivated the author's friends.
Starting back in 2008, 2009, sitting in the comfort of friends' living rooms in Portland, Oregon, where I reside, I would occasionally tell stories about my life as a transgender woman, things that happened to me in life. And people became so engrossed in my storytelling, they would say to me over and over again, "Denise, you should really write a book. You really should write a book." And I would always go, "Oh, yeah, I'll write a book. I'll write a book." And I sat down in 2010 out on the north shore of Kauai, and I started writing my book, and I wrote for the next 4 years. And when I finished, I had a manuscript of 650 pages. So, of course, the final book is nothing near that. It's 220 pages, but I was so excited to have my book published. I never expected that to happen the way it came down.
The gist of it is your journey as a trans person. And it's very adventure-filled, I must say. So, you know, maybe give people a little teaser of what they can expect to read.
My book goes back to the late 1950s when I had my first memories of being transgender at age 4, when I nearly drowned at my grandparents' lake cottage in southern Wisconsin. I was rescued. Had to wear one of my cousin's dresses when my clothes were drying. And that's when I knew that I was transgender. As soon as that dress was on me, I had this feeling. It was like just this revealing moment in my life where I felt proper and in the right role for myself. I knew that this was my future. It was a very difficult time, even at that young age, because my parents, as I began to exhibit transgender behavior, really tried to shut me down. And as a consequence, I found myself retreating deeper and deeper into a closet that was very hard to come out of, which is why it took me decades to break that routine that I'd found myself in. I had quite a male persona that I'd built up around myself all those decades. As a consequence of all that, I ended up using a lot of drugs and alcohol. I survived. I found a way to pull myself together, and I found a way to come out at age 49, 1 month shy of my 50th birthday. I went to Bangkok for my gender-affirming surgery, as it's called today. And since that time, life just opened up for me. It was such a great thing. My book does take you around the world to many different places. I tried to be as genuine and honest as I could in my book. I put it all out there is what I'm trying to say, and I didn't hold anything back. And so there's a lot of graphic language in my book of things where I found myself in very dangerous situations, and I managed to pull myself away from all that as well and survive.
Have you tapped into other trans writers?
When I first started writing my book, there were suggestions to me from others, oh, you should read this book on transgender, you should read this person's book on their story. And I kind of made an effort, a promise to myself, to stay away from reading other stories. I just wanted to write my own story.
Are there any questions that I haven't asked you, you wish people would, or things you want to say that I didn't ask?
For decades, I kept Denise in the closet. I didn't really have much of a choice in my life, and I had to do that. And it was a great feeling for me when at age 49, I was finally able to have Denise come out for good. So what was the first thing I did? I kicked Dennis in the closet for the next 12 years. And how fair was that to Dennis? Because here's the deal. Denise is always going to occupy center stage for the rest of her life. But I've realized that there should always be a bit role for Dennis on that same stage. Never forget where you came from. Never forget who you are. Always be your true self. And that doesn't matter if you're transgender or not. Just be sincere in your life. Be honest with others. Care for others. Learn to love yourself so you can learn to love others. That's one of the most important lessons in life. And being able to forgive others is another great lesson to learn in life that I'm still at times struggling with, but getting there. When you find and accept yourself for who you are, you could be a much better person to others in this world. I have a terrific website. I've been interviewed from here to Poland. That's all posted on my website, so selfmadewomanbook.com. Please join me there and follow me as I travel, hopefully the globe.
I gotta be free as the breeze, just wait and see.
Self-made woman author Denise Dubois was interviewed by Dixie Treichel.
I'm Stephen Fry. The great Oscar Wilde once said, "The only sin is stupidity." That is why it is imperative that we stay as informed as possible. An excellent way to do this is to listen to This Way Out, the international radio program for all our sexually diverse communities.
The historical exhibit is stirring a range of emotions in the UK. This Way Out correspondent Mary Milton takes us there.
I'm at Kingston Lacey, a National Trust property in Dorset. It was the home of William John Banks until in 1841 he fled to Italy in exile in order to escape prosecution for homosexuality. Today, the National Trust are proudly flying the rainbow flag, and I know inside there's an exhibition to honour William John Banks and to tell his story. I'm here to see that, and to meet the people who've designed it.
My immediate reaction walking into Kingston Lacey is, wow, you really don't miss about the message here. I'm with Richard and Julie, who've put this exhibition together. Julie, tell me where we are and what this represents.
This is the entrance hall of Kingston Lacey. This is the beginning of the Exile Project. And you walk straight into this what we call transitional space, where people leave and people come in, into 51 thick manila rope pieces hanging from a wooden structure. And they each represent a man who was killed under laws of the criminalisation of homosexuality at the time of William John Banks, who lived in this house. So throughout his life, 51 people, 51 men were killed under laws of the time. So,
and we've been interrupted by a voice now that's reading names.
They're the names of these 51 people, and they've been read by the staff and volunteers of Kingston Lacey in workshops that we held to include everybody who is currently in Kingston Lacey in this exhibition.
That was really important to us, to have that collaboration, because it makes them human. These were people who were brothers, fathers, they were family members, and when you hear the voices from men and women, young and old, living today, it hammers home that these were not just names from the past. They are people, real living people with connections, lives and loves, and we really wanted to make that a very human story.
Shall we move in further to the exhibition? We've left the ropes, which were hugely, hugely dramatic, I have to say. Just seeing them as you come through the entrance hall, it made me think of things that are happening today as well. And you've continued that throughout the house, that theme.
Yeah, we really wanted to focus on William John Banks' story, that story from 1841, but recognise that there are connections between his experiences and the experiences of LGBTQ people today. And that's something we really try and surface in this room that we're in now, which is called the Spanish Room.
This room is possibly where we feel closest to William John in this house. It is absolutely opulent golds, and most of this came from when he was in exile. Most of these paintings, most of the gold leather work, he wasn't here to see this. What we're looking at are three Georgian windows that look out over his estate. The central one has been photographed and filmed to create this projection. You look through this window and the landscape changes. This is like a stage looking out to the rest of the world, and we see other people's words and experiences and locations come up, so we can get reminded that this is actually happening in other countries today.
We should say a little bit about William John Banks' story as well. So he inherited this house, and then he was caught in a compromising position with a soldier, is that correct?
Yeah, twice.
Right, so okay, so there wasn't any doubt about this.
There wasn't any doubt about this story. The first time he was caught, that went to trial, and he was acquitted. And it was a few short years later when he was caught again with a guardsman in Green Park. And that time, there was a sense that he might not have been so lucky. So he didn't risk that. He didn't go to trial. He had 12 days, as I understand that, and in that time he organised his affairs and he fled.
Derek and Gordon, you didn't know the exhibition was on today,
no,
did you?
You walk in the doorway and it's awe-inspiring, if you like. It's very emotive. It makes you stand there and think about your own person, your own body, if you like, and you're looking at all these knots in the ropes and thinking, that could have been me 100 years ago.
Yeah, it could have been us, couldn't
it?
It
could have been us, yeah. But that's how it's changed.
When you come to places like this, how often do you see the LGBT story told, your story?
This is the first.
The first time, yeah.
This is a first. It's a new groundbreaking.
What does it mean to you that the National Trust can do this?
Very special. And we've come on it by accident today, really. It's very nice. I've never known anything like this before, really.
51 bodies.
50, yeah.
You can see them.
We feel that it's like those people, they've lived, and yet they've been done out of their lives. In history, that 170-odd years ago, just like yesterday, really.
You drop in the ocean.
And it's not like today, is it?
No.
Today,
no.
Things are different.
Yeah.
Things are so different.
Yeah.
So different.
Yeah. Like
it just shows you how far we've come from.
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, you guys are married now, aren't you? Recently married.
Yeah, this year.
Yeah.
On your 60th birthday, we got married, didn't we?
So those two gentlemen to come in and connect like that, they can make a connection they wouldn't have been able to have done prior to Exile being on here. It's very heartwarming to see people be recognised and acknowledged, and they've taken advantage of the law to be married. And they talked about, you know, 100 years ago they couldn't do that. It's painfully recent.
Normally you kind of do projects like this and you hear for the preview and then you leave, but the three of us, Tom, Julie and I, really wanted to stay around and see people's responses. I don't think we quite expected the power for a lot of people. There's been some very, very emotional responses we've just seen, and we've seen it from staff too. And it is blow away, really. Yeah, really, really hard hitting. You've probably seen that the whole Prejudice and Pride programme has attracted some controversy and some negativity, and it reminds us why it's really, really important to do it. And then when you hear responses like that, it's really underscores why it's important. And the National Trust's its values are very clearly stated, that to be forever for everyone, and what that means is really being there for everyone and welcoming people and enabling, like, those two guys to have the experiences that they've had.
Does that sort of reaction, does that make it worthwhile?
It does. When we started this project, I hadn't fully realised what an emotional journey it would be for us as researchers and colleagues here in the Trust. It has been extraordinarily personal at times, so that is very, very encouraging. We shall leave at the end of the day knowing that the project, at least with some people, has achieved what we really wanted it to.
The Exile installation is open every day until the 12th of November. To find out more about Kingston Lacey, go to www.nationaltrust.org.uk.
Our thanks for that report to Mary Milton. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Francis O'Brien and Wenzel Jones, produced by Steve Pride, Dixie Trackle, and Mary Milton. Ella Fitzgerald and Adam Lambert performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Arisha Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on WVEW Brattleboro, Vermont, 7THE Hobart, Tasmania, KSPC Claremont, California, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.